we'll start a minute early. Hi, everybody. We're going to get started on lecture number three now. I wanted to mention you've probably seen this already in the course announcement, but one student in the class, Ted Phelan, has very kindly arranged that students will be able to get free copies of two books. You remember I put on the required reading originally a book by Leonard Peikoff, which is called Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand. This is considered by the Ayn Rand Institute the most authoritative account of Rand's philosophy. But we found, and we like on the required readings just to give things that are available for free. You know, it's hard enough you have to pay for the course. We don't want you to pay extra for the course. So we found on, I thought this was available on Google Books, at least most of it. We found it wasn't very easy to get on Google Books. So Ted has arranged that if you follow the procedure that's set forward in this announcement you'll find on the news for the course, you can get a free copy of that book. And you can also get the book that Rand wrote herself, her only full-scale philosophical book called Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, where this gives her theory of concepts. Remember I spoke about that last lecture, theory of concepts. And you can also, in that same book, you'll find this very important essay by Peikoff called The Analytic Synthetic Dichotomy. You remember this is one that I suggested that if you possibly can, you should read because it's really basic to understanding the objectivist metaphysics. It's really an important essay. So if you don't have those two items, I urge everybody to take advantage of this offer. Just write to the place and you'll get the free books. Now, before I get to the lecture, a couple of preliminary matters. There was one person I was quite surprised who complained that my tests are too easy. You know, I try to make very easy tests. I remember my greatest teacher, Walter Starkey, used to say, give all A's and B's, that way you build up a following. And I try to follow that rule. But if people want harder tests, I can certainly do that. I think Danny mentioned it's going to be conducting a survey to see if people want harder tests. Maybe I could just get the same test and just fail certain people. The ones who want the harder test, give them a higher probability of failing. So that way everybody can get what he wants. I thought, also I'd mention, I thought it was an interesting comment. Remember when my first lecture, when I was giving it at the Mises Institute, that we were having trouble with the sound, so I recorded another version of that lecture. This was a YouTube video. So one person commented on the YouTube, you can put comments that I sound like a droopy dog on sleeping pills, but that the person thought at least I had a coherent line of thought. Well, it was very, I never thought of that before, that I sound like droopy dog, but I like droopy dog, so I was nice of that person to say that. So I don't know whether the person's in the course. I thought I'd just pass that on. So just think of droopy dog and then enroll in my courses. Now, the topic today, that I'll be talking about today and also in the lecture for next time, is Rand's ethics. And what I'm going to do is I'll follow the format I did in the first two lectures where I'll start off in the lecture today. I'll give a survey of Rand's views on ethics, so you get kind of an overall picture of what her view was. And then in the next lecture, just like I did in the second lecture, we'll go into some of the criticism that can be made of the argument. We'll look at the argument, the exact argument she gave, more closely. But what I'll be doing is today is giving a general survey of her ethics. Where she fits points from the last time. One was, I'm not satisfied with one thing I said, or a couple things I said last time. Remember when I was giving Rand's view, one of the views is except for human choices, everything in the world exists necessarily. So say light has a certain speed, it necessarily has that speed. Every property that something has, it has necessarily. Now, I said at one point when I was describing this to you, I said that Rand holds that objects have all their properties essentially, so every property in the object is part of the property's essence. And when I said that, I was using essence the way it's usually used in philosophy rather than the way objectivists use that term. You probably surmise by now my background in philosophy isn't objectivist. I'm much more of a mainstream analytic style philosopher. So I was using the term essence the way it's usually used in philosophy. But the objectivism, essence means something else. It's an epistemological rather than a metaphysical comment. Concept. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, remember, in Rand's theory of concept, where you perceive the similarities and differences among things through the senses, and then by measurement and emission, you see what these various things have in common, and that gives you your concept. So when you get a concept, you define the concept by what you think best explains all the characteristics of the various objects the concept refers to. Remember, for Rand, suppose I say I have a concept of a table. Well, table refers or means all the various tables that exist or will exist or have existed. That's what table means. But the definition of a table is just a kind of an item of furniture that you put things on very roughly. That's the definition, but that's not the meaning. The meaning is all the objects it refers to. The definition gives you the essence, what you think best explains all the characteristics of the table. That would be the essence. So this is epistemological concept. If you come up with more information about the obvious, you could change what the essence is. You're not likely to make any change in the tables. Say you're trying to get a concept of, say, molecules of a certain element or atoms of that element. You might very well come up with different, more information and change the concept of change what the essence or definition is. So, see, in mainstream philosophy, an object's property can be divided into two classes. This is mainstream philosophy, not Rand's philosophy. One class is the essential characteristics. You say the object wouldn't be that the object it is without those properties. So, suppose you say something like, a table has to be made of some durable material. You couldn't have, say, a table made out of sugar. It has to be some kind of material that will stand up. So that would be an essential characteristic. Then the rest of the properties are non-essential. I suppose I'm looking right now in my house at a brown dining room table. Well, being brown in this isn't an essential property of the table, right? It's used in mainstream philosophy. But for objectivists, an object must have all its characteristics, if you don't consider human choices. But the object must have all its characteristics. But objectivists wouldn't say, as I did the last time, that all the object's characteristics are essential, because the essence, again, is epistemological. It's just what you would need for your definition, what enables you to best understand, to best explain the various characteristics of the items of the concept means or refers to. So see, I shouldn't have said that last time. I was using essence the way mainstream philosophers use it rather than the way objectivists do. But this is, after all, of course, in objectivist philosophy, so I should have used the objectivist definition. And now, some Joy wants to know, it's just two books. I think they are mentioned on the website. It's Objectivism Philosophy of Ayn Rand and Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, those two books. And Jerry mentions that there's a definition of discussion of essence in Binswanger's edited book, Ayn Rand Lexicon. Well, that's very good. Somebody wants an email, yes. I'll make sure I have your email so I can send you those. Okay, now the next point, it's interesting, Jerry made a comment. The next comment, I think, I wanted to comment on, was something that I think Jerry was the one who raised it. Now, I said, remembering my last lecture, the criticism I raised of objectivism was that very often, or at least it seemed that way to me, that the objectivists don't give arguments, or very much in the way of argument, in defending their views. They'll say, for example, here's the theory of concepts that we hold, but they don't really give arguments. Why is that the right theory of concept, not some other theory? Now, Jerry, if I've got him, if I'm remembering correctly, pointed out that objectivists emphasize what they call a spiral arrangement of the objectivist doctrine. If you read the Peikoff's book or the book by Thompson Kelly that's on the required reading, they stress that the various doctrines of objectivism support one another, so that one principle leads to the next. Suppose you start with their view of concept formation, then you can get you can go on to their view of why the actual world is the only possible world. So then later, so you get one principle leads next, but then also later principles further explain and add support for earlier ones. So they could say, well, look, we do have support for our views because they have a spiral where the earlier views lead to the later ones, and the later ones will in turn support the earlier ones. We see what I think is a problem there is that would certainly show, if they carry this out, the objective system is a consistent one, that say that the various doctrines of objectivism don't contradict one another. But then the question would come up, well, why should you accept the whole system? You could imagine all sorts of consistent systems, but they could be false. You wouldn't have to adopt them. So it is a point in the objectivist's favor. They can show consistent arrangement for what they want. But then there's the further question, should we accept the whole system? Now, we can now go on to the main topic today, which is Rand's ethics. Now, objectivists say that all ethical systems can be divided into two categories. Those that are based on individual self-interest and those that support sacrifice to collective or to other people. So there'd be two, in this view, there'd be two kinds of ethics. One would say, well, here's how, what you should do in order to lead a good life. So each person would be saying to himself or herself, how can I lead a good life? What do I need to do to lead a good life? And ethics would tell you, would give you answers to that. And then there'd be other ethical theories that would say, well, what the primary thing in ethics is that you have duties to other people, or you have duties to a collective like your nation or the race or the race you're in or the human race. So you have duties to some other. So ethics isn't about self-interest. Ethics really is about what you can do for some other others, whether in the particular individual or some collective entity. Now, what we're going to say about this division, or the saying that we have this division between ethical theories based on self-interest and those based on altruism. So altruism, you know, can anyone tell me who coined the word altruism? Does anyone know that? Of course, the notion of giving things to others is a one that's long ago. Lots of people know that. You're going back to ancient history. Yes, Bill Anderson is right. Auguste Comte, the 19th century French pacifist philosopher, he coined the word altruism. So this division, according to Rand, is between egoism and altruism. Now we can see this division isn't logically required, because what would be logically required, we would say all theories of ethics have to be either egoist or non-egoist. This would follow the law of non-contradiction, just like everything is either A or not A, so we get all ethical theories would be either egoist or non-egoist. But it wouldn't follow from that that all ethical theories have to be either egoist or altruist. That would be, if you said that, that would be a contrary. So altruism is at the opposite extreme from egoism. But what about there could be space in between? There could be systems of ethics that wouldn't be either. For example, suppose you had a system of ethics saying, well, we have some duties to ourselves and also duties to other people. So the purpose of ethics isn't either to help ourselves all the time or to help other people all the time, but sometimes have to do one, sometimes have to do the other. So you could have a system of ethics that falls into neither of these categories. Now, in spite of the fact that this division isn't logically required, I think one of Rand's greatest contributions was her criticism of altruism. And why I think this is one of her great, great contributions is that collectivist morality has had disastrous consequences throughout history, and particularly if we look the history of the 20th century. I want to give a few examples of that. So what I want to do is sort of give the background of altruistic views so we can see what was Rand reacting against when she advanced her doctrine of egoism, ethical egoism. Now, if you look at the Nazis, one of their slogans was that the common good comes before the individual good. So what, in their view, that individual lives have to be sacrificed for the good of the master race. So one of their views was that there were certain people, say people with certain hereditary diseases, who should be done away with or prevented from having children. If you said to them, what about the rights of those individuals? They would say it's what's for the good of the race. So it's the master race. If someone asked a question, good by what standard? So what Nazi would be, good for the race, so it's your duty to sacrifice yourself for this master race. Of course, you're not in the master race, then you're in even worse shape. But you see, this is an example of what Rand would term an altruistic morality. You're supposed to be sacrificing yourself for the common good, for the good of this collective. So that's the standard. Now, Lucas asks, doesn't subjective utility make altruism irrational? Well, not necessarily. I mean, someone could have part of the prison's utility could be to help others. I mean, it would if you it would make you. It could be the case, certainly. Suppose you didn't feel like helping others, so that wouldn't particularly be an argument against these theories, because these theories say if you don't want to do it, this is what you should do. This is what you're required to do. They didn't claim that everybody in fact wants to help out the mass who raise such a sin. This is what you're required to do. This is what ethics is. Now, I want another notorious example of this view is you find among the communists. Now, there, of course, they didn't believe in the master race, but they thought that individuals' well-being should be subordinated to the goal of the communist revolution, and that people should be willing to sacrifice themselves for future generations. So they were perfectly well aware, if you look at during the 30s and 40s, they were very well aware that people in the Soviet Union, in Soviet Russia, weren't doing very well. But they said, well, what you should do, what the goal of ethics is to help advance the communist revolution. So even if you have to give up your own life, you should be willing to do that, because just the point of ethics is to advance the proletarian revolution and to advance communism. So this is the kind of view. Of course, Rand grew up in Soviet Russia, so this is the kind of view she was reacting very strongly against. Now, just to continue a bit, I think it's I want to emphasize how influential these altruistic and collectivist views were, so we can see the point, why is she so insistent on ethical egoism. We can see collectivist morality played a major role in World War I propaganda. One theme, say, if you look at, British wartime propaganda, was that people could achieve moral regeneration by sacrificing themselves for a cause. The cause would be British to the preservation of civilization against the German attack. Of course, the Germans, from their point of view, said, well, we're preserving culture, and if you should sacrifice yourself for us, because we're the ones who are preserving culture against the forces that are trying to destroy our culture. So see, if you just look at the British, for example, if you look, say, at Rupert Brooke, who's an extremely popular poet at the time, in one of his poems, he talked about war sonnets. He has a line where he's describing going into war. He says, "A swimmer is into cleanness leaping, glad from a world grown old and cold and weary." So here, the collective struggle is something that you get, that is really gives you the meaning of life. You're subordinating yourself to the collective struggle. This is what really gives you the basis for ethics. And we can look, say, just another example. We could get a whole lot of examples if this were a course on history. But maybe look at the Peter Taylor Forsyth, who's one of the greatest British theologians of the time, had a book called The Justification of God that came out during World War I, the Congregationalist theologian. And he compared the sacrifice that people make in war to Christ's sacrifice on the cross to redeem mankind. So he said, we're imitating Christ by being willing to sacrifice ourselves for the common good. Now, also in the 20th century, Forsyth was just one example. There was an influential interpretation of Christianity that claimed that the New Testament taught self-sacrificial love for others at the base of ethics, so that in this view, which isn't, I'm not just saying that this is the correct interpretation of Christianity, it's just one view that was very prominent in the 20th century. So what you're doing, what the base of Christian ethics, the base of New Testament ethics, is that you should sacrifice yourself for other people. And the most influential book favoring that view was one by the Swedish theologian, who was later bishop of the Swedish church, called Agape and Eros. If you have a chance, you might want to look at that. It's a very long book, extremely learned. This is the most comprehensive statement of this position. So we can distinguish love in the sense where you find something attractive, or you're attracted to something. This is not really the Christian concept of love. Christian concept of love is totally self-giving. So see, this would be a perfect example of a sort of altruistic view that Rand was opposing. Now, among Christians, there is a counter-view to this that emphasized the command, thou shalt love thy neighbors thyself. So people took that view and said, well, look, you have to love yourself, because it says as thyself. So this view said you have to sacrifice yourself for others isn't the correct view, but it was nevertheless an influential one. Now, these views, these altruistic views, continue today. I'll just give an example, because you've probably heard this one. Peter Singer, who's an Australian moral philosopher teaching at Princeton now, has argued that we have a moral duty to give large amounts of our wealth to help the poor all over the world to avoid death by disease and starvation. Are people here familiar with Singer's arguments? Anybody heard of Peter Singer? Well, I guess nobody's saying yes. So basically he says, imagine that you're coming along and you see a baby who's drowning in a pool of water, and you can just pull the baby out, but if you did that, you get your clothes all wet. So wouldn't we want to say, well, it's your duty to pull the baby out because you'd be saving the baby's life. Even wouldn't it be awful if you said, well, I don't want to save the baby because then I get my suit wet. But if we say that, then don't we have to say, well, if we gave, say, money to some charity that would give some money, say, to Bangladesh or to Somalia, we could save somebody from starving. So don't we have a duty to do that? And then you just keep iterating this, are you saying, again, well, don't I have a duty to help somebody out if I can't? So you would end up that you have to give large amounts of your income, so otherwise you'd be getting the, if you don't do that, you're really killing people, because say you're saying something like, well, I'd prefer spending some, say, $50 on dinner at a nice restaurant rather than just eating just what I need to get by on helping all these other people live, so don't have a duty to do this. You know, if you go to YouTube, you can see the comedian Louis C.K. did in his comedy routine, he did a perfect summary of Singer's argument, and people were just laughing and thinking, it must be absurd, but this is actually a serious argument. So this is the kind of view Rand is opposed to, but it's a very influential one. One that says, well, what we have to do in ethics really is help other people or help some collective. Now, there's a counter tradition to this view that what the purpose of ethics is, or what we're doing in ethics is to sacrifice ourselves for some collective or to help other people. If you look at Greek ethics, especially the ethics of Aristotle, this emphasizes the goal of ethics is the individual's pursuit of the good life. So if you look, say, at Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, what he's doing is telling you, well, what virtues should you want to acquire in order to lead a good life. Now, this doesn't exclude doing things for others, but that isn't the primary purpose of ethics. The primary purpose of ethics is your own pursuit of a good life. And the Greek term for this is eudaimonia, which means something like happiness or flourishing. So this tradition is one that says, no, what you're doing in ethics is not primarily helping others or sacrificing somebody. It's asking, how can you lead a good life? Of course, this is the tradition Rand places yourself in. It's also, Ludwig von Mises also explicitly placed himself in this tradition. He refers, if you look at his discussion of ethics in his book Socialism, he talks about the notion of eudaimonia. I missed some questions here. Oh, somebody, I'm sorry, I missed some points here. People don't agree with Peter Singer, I'm not surprised. Now, I just give one question. Yes, I see we have some people who know Singer. I should have known that. Now, as someone asked, would Rand say you shouldn't save the baby? No, I don't think she would say that. I think what she would probably say would be people would have some, tend to have sympathy for others. So most people probably would, but you're not required to, and it wouldn't for her be something that you would be under a strict obligation to do. So I think it wouldn't be important for her that helping others would be all right, but you wouldn't have to do it. Now, I want to mention now another key division in ethics. Remember I mentioned the first one is that between self-interested theories and altruistic views. Now, another related distinction is, which relates to this distinction between self-interest and collectivism, has to do with the reason we should be moral. And here again, there are two main answers. One is that it's in your interest to be moral. So if somebody says, why should I be moral? Why should I follow morality? Suppose morality says you're supposed to respect other people's property rights. Why should I do that? So one answer would be, well, it's in your interest to be moral. This is what morality is in your interest, so that gives you a reason to do it. It would be similar. Suppose I say, somebody, I'm thinking, should I take up smoking cigarettes? And I say, well, no, I don't want to do that because smoking is bad for your health. I don't want to increase my chance of getting lung cancer, so I'm not going to smoke. So this would be a good reason not to smoke if my information is correct, because it would be in my interest not to smoke. So since Rand thinks the purpose of morality is to promote your own life, she fits into this category. So she said, well, the reason we should be moral is that this is what's going to, morality just is what helps you promote your own life, so that gives you a reason to follow it. Now, there's an alternative view that morality makes demands on you. So if you say, well, morality is in what's my interest, that's telling you what you should do in the sense of this would be good advice for you. You'd be well advised to do something. Say, I could say, to somebody, you'd be well advised not to smoke because it will have bad consequences for your health if you do. But according to this other alternative, morality is not telling you what you'd be well advised to do, what you should do in the sense of what would be to your advantage, but it's making demands on you, saying you must do this, whether it's to your advantage or not. So this morality is telling you this is what you have to do. And probably the greatest statement of this view is by the British philosopher Harold Arthur Pritchard, in an essay that came out in Mind's British Philosophy Journal called "Does Moral Philosophy Rest on a Mistake?" And he answered, "Yes, it does." And he said, "The mistake is people ask what is the reason you should be moral? Why should I be moral?" And Pritchard said, well, if you ask this question, why should you be moral, you're reducing morality to something else. You're saying morality isn't something that's just there in itself telling you this is what you're required to do. It's saying, well, you should be moral because it's in your interest to do this or some other reason. But if you do that, you're really rejecting morality because morality is making certain absolute demands on you. So this definitely is not Rand's view. Now, one thing to notice, this is not the same distinction as the one I made before. Remember the earlier distinction between self-interest and collectivism. So that has to do with the content of morality. That's one account would be what content of morality is, how I can lead a good life. The other says, no, morality is what you should do, what you should sacrifice yourself for the collective or for other people. So this isn't the same as this distinction, which is the reason you should be moral, not the content of morality. So someone who wasn't a collectivist, somebody could support the moral duty position, although this might be unusual. Somebody could say, well, each person morally should do what would best advance his own interests. So it's morally required that you try to lead a good life in the sense of a life that will advance your own interest. If you say, well, why should I do that? What if I don't feel like doing that? Then the answer would be, well, this is what morality requires. This is the absolute demand of morality. Now, that wasn't Rand's view. I just mentioned it because that's a possible position. So you shouldn't confuse these decisions. One is saying the content of morality, you have this distinction between individual, certain moralities, say, talk about individual self-interest, others types of morality, talk about sacrificing individual to collective. Then you have this other question, why should I be moral? Is it that morality is in your interest? So that's why you should be moral, or is it that morality is giving an absolute demand on you? So Rand comes on, the content of morality is what's in your interest, what will help you lead a good life, and the reason you should be moral is just the same, that this will help you lead a good life. But there are two questions, different questions, you see. Now, suppose, like Rand, you think that ethics aims to promote self-interest, so that each person will be saying, how can I lead a good life for myself? So what you might think at first, well, won't this lead to a problem? What if everybody accepts and acts on this? What if everybody says, well, I'm going to see how can I lead a good life for myself? I'm not primarily concerned with how you're leading a good life for yourself, but I'm interested in what's good for me. So won't this lead to conflict because people just be fighting each other and say, well, I'm doing what's best for me. The other one would say, I'm doing what's best for me. Like imagine, say, you have, imagine there's people at a party, there's a cake that a lot of people want to have. So somebody says, well, I want almost all the cake for myself. And another one says, well, I want all the cake for myself. So aren't they going to be fighting about this? So if wouldn't egoism necessarily lead to fights? Now, Rand didn't think so. And she thought that people's interests are in fundamental harmony. So you advance your own interests by cooperating with others, not by fighting with them. You'll find, you imagine my situation with people at the party, just kind of a very commonplace example. You won't advance your own interests if you, when you go to a party, if you just grab the cake all for yourself, you won't. People will stop you, or you won't be invited to more parties in the future. You'll get along much better if you cooperate with others. And people through the free market can do much better in peaceful interactions. Each one will be advancing what's best for himself or herself by peaceful cooperation with others rather than by fighting with them, rather than by using force or just grabbing what you want from other people. And this is a principal theme of Atlas Shrugged and other fiction. Remember in Atlas Shrugged, John Galt and the other industrialists are creating industries. They're doing this because they're creative. They want to do the building industry will be an expression of their creativity to their own advantage, but they're conveying tremendous benefits to other people. And then it's the government that interferes with them and tries to restrict them. So the government is interfering with them. So even though they're operating egoistically, or rather say because they're operating egoistically, they're benefiting others by what they do, because the free market is vastly more productive than any possible alternative. And this point is also basic to Ludwig von Mises' ethics. He stresses that what the free market makes possible peaceful cooperation. He calls this the law of association. People can get together and cooperate, but each one is advancing his own interests, but cooperating will get them much further than fighting. Let me see someone who had a comment. Okay. Now, I want to go into the particular details of how Rand's egoistic views. In the next lecture, we'll go into more detailed kind of whether these arguments work and to what extent we should accept them or modify them. Now, Rand asks, why is there such an institution, by institution she means a custom or a practice, of ethics or morality? Why does morality exist? And she finds basically the answer to her question in biology. She says, well, animals survive by instinct. They automatically do what's required to ensure their survival. Say, if you notice, like when I go down the street, sometimes I'll see a squirrel, and I'll see when the squirrel sees me, the squirrel will just run away and climb up a tree. The squirrel doesn't know whether I'm a possible threat, so it's automatically programmed. Some kind of large being that might be dangerous to it to run away. So animals do what's required automatically to ensure their survival. But human beings aren't like that. Remember, Rand takes the rather strong view that it would be questioned by many biologists. We don't have instincts at all, but if you don't go all the way with her. She's certainly right that we don't operate entirely on instincts, but we have to rely on reason in order to live. We have to figure out for ourselves how to live. It isn't just done automatically by biology, biological programming. We're not programmed to survive. We have to use reason in order to survive. So, according to her, the fact that human beings need to use reason in order to survive gives us the point and purpose of ethics. So this answers the questions of why is there a practice, why is there such an institution as ethics? And the answer, according to her, is that we need this practice in order to survive. Ethics tells us how to survive, so that's the whole point of it. So she defines a value as what one acts to gain or keep. So supposing I say I want to have food, I need to have food in order to live, so food is a value for me because this is something I'm acting to gain or keep. Or I like reading books a great deal, keeps me. That's how I earn my living, studying books, writing about them. So reading books is for me a value, it's something I would try to act to gain or keep. So the point we just discussed, namely that human beings need to use reason in order to survive, will tell us what we should act to gain or keep. Now, someone adds, we analyze, survive, and thrive. This is the point I'll be discussing later, what exactly is involved in surviving and what goes along with it. It's good that you mentioned that. Now, one of the most important controversies in ethics, which you'll find, so if you take a course in ethics involving various ethical theories, is whether morality is objective. And here, of course, they're not talking about the system of objectivism we're studying in this course. But by objective, as most philosophers understand this, what the question means is, can moral judgments be true or false? Suppose I say killing people for fun is wrong. Well, most people would agree with that, but can I say that's a true statement in the sense that I say something like Los Angeles is located to the west of New York is a true statement, straightforwardly true or false. So can our moral judgment be true or false in that sense? Now, if you answer no, that involves accepting some kind of moral subjectivism. An example, what would I say, I like vanilla ice cream, but supposing you don't. There are some people who don't like vanilla ice cream, even some people, hard as it may be to believe, who don't like ice cream at all. So we can't say that either of us is correct or incorrect. Just we have different preferences. Alexander said, is like ice cream really moral subject? Well, of course, it isn't, but I'm just using this as an analogy to show what a subjectivist view is. So we would say, or at least most people say, well, there's no correct or incorrect about whether you should like vanilla ice cream, just some people like it, some people don't. It's just a matter of opinion. So subjectivists think moral judgments are like that. There isn't any true or false about the matter. So in this view, it's moral judgments are just subjective preference, and it might be most people have the same subjective preferences. you won't find many people saying it's all right to kill children for fun, but that just shows on the subjectivist view most people have that preference. It doesn't show that it's true in some objective sense, in the sense that it's a matter of fact that it's wrong to kill children for fun. It's just that most people have that preference. So if you talk about objectivity in that, the way we just distinguished, Rand counts as a believer in objectivity. She thought that it wasn't just a matter of opinion that the purpose of ethics is for each person his or her own survival. This is true in a straightforward sense. I mean, supposing you said that, this, according to Rand, this is what I need to do in order to survive. So she says, Alexandra, she's pointing out, this is what you ought to do. You ought to do what's required to survive according to your nature as a living entity. Both of them said, well, I don't care about that. What I want to do is what I feel like doing now. I don't care about what you say. She would say, well, that person is just wrong. It's not taking the true view, which is that you should do what you need in order to survive, or survive as a rational being. Now, so she's a supporter of objective morality in the way we just explained. She's not a subjectivist. She believes in objective morality. However, she separates her version of objectivity from another position, which she calls intrinsicism. Sometimes I have difficulty pronouncing that word. It's kind of an unusual word, intrinsicism. She didn't invent that word, but she used that. That's a position she really doesn't like at all. I see there's quite a distinction that we can go on that Hume is and ought, really. We can discuss that more in the discussion period. Now, many philosophers who accept moral objectivity, let's say, who think that moral judgments are true or false independent of people's preferences or how what we think of them, reason in this way. Well, if morality is objectively true, then say if it's objectively true that it's wrong to kill children for fun, then the propositions of morality aren't up to us. It isn't that we decide it's wrong to kill children for fun, just that's what's the case, that's what's true. So then these philosophers will reason, they'll say, well, if these propositions of morality aren't up to us, then their truth holds independently of us, in the sense that things are valuable or not, regardless of our relations to them. So, as an example, the British philosopher G.E. Moore, remember him from the last lecture, I was talking about Moorean facts, such as we say, the world, I know that the external world exists, and I'm more certain of this than I am of it. Any skeptical argument that I don't know because in its own that's I call that a Moorean fact after Moore, G. Moore, who used that argument. So Moore had interesting things to say about ethics as well and aesthetics. And he said, this is an example of an intrinsic's point of view, he said, imagine a beautiful object, say some just some beautiful arrangement of the stars. He said, this would be valuable even if we were in a universe that the universe had no conscious beings. Imagine, say, a pile of garbage. This would be something that would be bad or have this valuable. Even if you imagine all human beings wiped out, supposing there's an atomic war, everybody's killed, but there's tremendous destruction all around. You see all sorts of waste. So he said this would be an objectively bad state of affairs, even no human beings at all. So he, this is an example of an intrinsicist position. He said that some things that just are good or bad, regardless of what, whether there are people around at all. So as Randall points out, this would be a view Rand very strongly rejects. So she, as I said, she rejected intrinsicism. So things aren't good or bad in themselves, and we can see why would she say that, because remember, a value, as she's defined it, is what one acts to gain or keep. So if there are no people, then there are no values, because there's nothing that you're, there's no people, so there's nothing that people can act to gain or keep, because there are no people. So she's rejecting this intrinsicist point of view to say, if it, there are just things that are valuable or not valuable, it doesn't matter whether there are people to try to get those things, they just are valuable. Just as we could say, when we say a diamond has certain properties, like it's hard or shaped, it has certain shaped a certain way, it would have this these properties regardless of whether people admired diamonds. So similarly, someone who's an intrinsicist might say, well, a diamond is beautiful even if there are no people who admire it or try to get it. So that would be a position Rand strongly rejects. She said, no, values aren't intrinsic. So when she talks about objectivism in the world, she doesn't mean, as most philosophers define the term today, just mean a view that says statements about values or ethical propositions are true or false, have a true value. She means her own position where ethical judgments are true or false, but they involve a relation between people and values. So it isn't that the values are true or false in themselves, it's that they're true or false because of their relation to people. And she takes her objectivist view to be in between subjectivism and intrinsicism. The judge said values are just whatever a person prefers, they're entirely subjective. Intrinsicist says, well, values are just out there, they're absolutes out in the world. And Rand said, no, values are a relation between people and things in the world. They're things that people act to gain or keep. And what the standard you should use is what advances your own life as a rational being. So in her view, there's everyone in has a fundamental choice to make, whether to live or die. Now, suppose you don't choose to live. Say you say, well, I don't care about living, or I want to kill myself. So then no other choices have a rational basis. Being alive is a necessary condition for all other choices. I suppose you could come up with an example like somebody wanting to commit suicide, but she would say, well, even there you have to be alive in order to do that. Now, supposing we didn't have the choice to live or die, then nothing could matter to us. And she gives a famous example, the mortal robot. She imagines a robot that cares about living or dying, but nothing can kill it. It's going to be there regardless of what it does. It's all guaranteed to remain in existence. So then she thinks, well, nothing could matter to the robot. It couldn't have any other goals because it can't make this choice to live or die. So that's the, that choice underlies all other choices. Now, this is a point that I think Randall, if I'm not mistaken, suggested earlier. If we choose to live, in her view, we aren't choosing bare physical survival, or choosing a survival as a rational being. So it isn't something like supposing I could say I could be guaranteed to live if I could plug myself into some machine where I just go into a coma, say, for 100 years. That wouldn't count as choosing to live. It's choosing to live in some way that will be surviving as a rational being. So each person in this view is choosing to live rather than subordinate his life to some collective. But although her view is egoist in this sense, it isn't an egoist view in the sense that you can violate the rights of others. Each person in her view is supposed to try to advance his or her own life. So each person should respect the rights of others to make the same choice in their own life. So I can't say, well, it would help me, say, if I just took away something that you have, your property, so it would help me to live, so I'm going to take that, because I have to respect your right to live, to survive as a rational being. So any type of parasitism where you live at the expense of someone else is ruled out on her system. So I think that will conclude what I want to talk about today, where I just wanted to give a survey of her views and place it in the background, give a background to her views of certain collectivist views that she reacted against. And what we'll do the next time is go into the particular details of her argument and try to see whether these are correct or incorrect reasons. So in the rest of the time we'll have now questions, objections, anything you'd like to talk about. We have about half hour available for that. Now Peggy said man does both, but what is it that they do both? Wait, let me see. I'm not getting what that question is. Well, let's go on. Here's one. Ren said, perhaps we first Randall raised a point. Some actions that appear altruistic might just be examples of cooperation, reasonable empathy with others in certain act of life. I think Rand would certainly agree with that, so that, say, you take the example I gave where Singer's example where you're seeing a baby that you could save. Well, I think we would naturally feel sympathy, we probably would save the baby, but doing that doesn't commit us to some full-scale project where we're going to devote all or most of what we earn to saving babies all over the world. So I think people are, I think you're exactly on target, and that would be the way we would see matters. Let's see. Jonathan has something here. Quotes that for any living organism, life is ultimate value. Yes, Rand held that view because she said, animals other than human beings will try to advance their own life by instinct, but we can't do that. Now, Alexander said, what do you think about Rand's solutions is odd question? Well, what Rand thought was that, remember, David Hume said that suppose we just take a proposition about matters of fact, we can't logically deduce anything about what we ought to do. It's sometimes called Hume's law. Suppose I say something like smoking will lead to such and such diseases, it doesn't follow from that, according to Hume, that I shouldn't smoke. That involves a separate step. Don't have to add the premise, I shouldn't do what will lead to diseases or what would be bad for me. Now, what Rand would say is, I think, that there isn't any such gap, that once that what does it mean to say that you ought to do something? Remember, you get means of concepts, remember her to concept formation, how you get the meaning of the concepts through this process of abstraction. So she says, well, how we get the concept of ought, it's from looking at all these living things, including the beings, saying, how do the beings survive? So she's defined the concept of ought, what need to survive is what you ought to do. So there's no gap. It's part of the definition of ought, part of the concept of ought, that you should do what you need to do in order to survive. Now, whether she's right or not would be dependent, I think, on whether you think that's the correct definition of ought. And this is one thing I'll be going into in the next lecture. I'm inclined to be a bit skeptical about it myself, but I think that would be the way she would answer that. Now, Lucas asks, isn't self-ownership a prerequisite for pursuing self-interest? Well, I think it is in the sense you have to be something in control of your own body in order to pursue your interest if somebody else is stopping you from doing anything, and you can't pursue your self-interest. But I don't think self-ownership would be required in the sense that it has to be legally recognize that you own yourself in order to pursue your self-interest. I mean, we can imagine in slaves and slave society trying to do what they could to pursue their interest. Now, Alexander, I think from his comments, I think you buy into the Randian argument, so you can clear that's clear. All right, we have quite a bit of time. Let's see. I always keep seeing there's more things that I'm missing. Matthew says, do you find the argument to be subjective or objective ethics strong? Well, I go along with it in terms of finding the objectivist view. Objective view, not objectivist ethics. Rand uses objective ethics much stronger. I mean, I don't think it's simply a matter of preference, say, that killing people is wrong. It seems to be a matter of fact. And one thing I think we could use this as an argument is, supposing you imagine, say, some people arguing, one person says, well, I think we have a duty to equalize income. Somebody says, no, that's not right. You don't have such a duty. They're certainly disagreeing. Whatever you think, whichever one you think is right, of course, I think we don't have such a duty. You would certainly say they're disagreeing, but if ethical judgment was just subjective preferences, they wouldn't be disagreeing. One would be saying something like, I like equal income. The other would say, no, I don't like equal income. They wouldn't be disagreeing. They seem like they clearly are. So that would tend to show that ethical judgments are ones that you could say there's a matter of fact about. That, incidentally, is arguing from disagreement. That was also one of Gene Moore's arguments. Now, let's see, there's a question here from Jerry is, wait, let me see if I can read this. I think this is a very good insight Rand had. Jerry points out that Rand connects the appeal of collectivist schemes to the altruist base, calling this a sanction of the victim. So I think this is a very good insight. Suppose you have a view that says, well, we should sacrifice ourselves for the communist revolution. So initially people say, well, you might think, well, why would anybody want to do this? Suppose you say, well, if you like the communist revolution, what does that matter to me? Is it going to help me very much if you say I have to sacrifice my life, even bloody people do well? So the answer is that people will say, well, just the point of ethics is that you have to do things for others or for the collective. So I think this is a good insight that the reason these collectivist doctrines have some appeal is that people think they're ethically required to be altruistic in the sense of sacrificing themselves for others. Alexander wants to keep the questions coming. Well, I hope I can keep the answers coming. That's a little more difficult. Oh, Alexander likes the class. Yes, I knew you were a good guy, Alexander. Keep up the great work. You're doing well. This is the kind of comments I like. You made my day. Thank you. Now, let's see. Oh, somebody agrees. Oh, good for her, but you're also a good guy. Now, Jonathan wants to know why Rand was against private security and national defense. Well, this I'll be getting into in one of the later lectures, but basically she thought that in a society there has to be a single law code, and she thought that if you had competing protection agencies, you wouldn't be able to have such a law code. There'd be all sorts of fights about what the appropriate procedure was. Now, what Rothbard says is, well, various agencies would agree on common procedure, but she was skeptical about that. Yes, that's right, she didn't think computer journalism works. Oh yes, I see a lot of people interested in her views on this. Well, we'll be getting that in a later lecture. And I see, I think Jonathan is right, there's certainly a strong case to be made for competing protection agencies. One I agree with, of course, that wasn't Rand's view of the matter. I don't think it's one she studied at great length, but that clearly she was opposed to it. I remember, you know, one story when George Reisman used to lecture at Mises University, which he did several years ago. He and his wife, Edith Packer, who's a leading objectivist psychologist, would be very strong against anarchy. Anarchists, they'd always try to get arguments going. I remember there were some interesting arguments between them and Hans Hoppe and Roderick Long. They were a lot of fun at the time. Now, Peggy asks, can common good be defined? That's a very good question, Peggy. Well, that depends on what the particular ethical system is, or particular view. Now, you could have a notion of common good on an objectivist or libertarian position, where the common good would simply be what's good for each individual. It wouldn't be a good for some kind of collective entity apart from the individual. So you could still have a sense of common good in that way. But each of these collectivist views would have their own notion of what common good is. So it would vary with whatever the view was. Now I see there are a lot of comments on this private protection agencies versus single agency. I think you're right, there's a very interesting question, but if possible, could we try to keep the discussion to the lecture topic today? We'll have a lot of time to get into that in some later lectures. And now, Well, I see some someone asked, would Rand agree with our Second Amendment rights? Well, she didn't really talk about that very much. Now, Leonard Peikoff, who is her the heir, has been rather critical of individuals owning guns. I don't think he's that they shouldn't be allowed to, but he doesn't emphasize that much. He thinks certainly the government should be able to ban dangerous weapons. So he's not a strong Second Amendment supporter. I see. Wait a sec. Let's see someone else. We're having a lot of questions on this competing governments. Well, if anyone has something on something else, I mean, remember in this class we don't have competing governments. I'm in charge, so I'd rather you talk about the topic today, if possible. Okay, so we still have another 15 minutes or so. Does anyone have any questions on foundation? Alexander's trying to think of questions. Well, did Rand ever respond to Emotivist? Well, I think she and Peikoff have brief comments about that. See, what they said, remember, you want to look at that essay by Peikoff on the analytic synthetic dichotomy. Remember, the emotivist basically said, well, we can distinguish two types of meaningful statements. There are analytic statements, which are statements about kind of logical truths or definitions, like the bachelor is an unmarried man, it's analytic, it's a definition. Then there are factual statements, they're statements about the world. I'm giving a lecture now. That's an empirical or factual statement. So positive said, well, what about things that don't fall under either category? They would be meaningless. A meaningful statement has to be either analytic or empirical. So moral judgments, according to them, are meaningless. They don't have empirical meaning. Suppose I say, again, killing children is wrong. I'm just expressing a preference for not killing children. Killing children, boo. I don't like killing children. So what the objectivist response is that this division between analytic and empirical statements is wrong, that moral judgments and other statements, there's only one kind of true statement, that's say, one derived in the way explained by Rand's theory of concept from the external world. So all statements are. So that would be her response to the motivist. They're just wrong about the nature of moral language. Somebody has something on behavior of squirrels. Oh, that's interesting. There's some question that there on whether Rand had pets, that she had cats. Now, Matthew asked, is the basic ethics in biology widely held outside the objectivist community? It's one of the views. There are certainly philosophers who hold that view. Philip of Foote, who was a very influential British philosopher, had a sort of a natural law view that's rather like Rand's, but she wasn't objective. I mean, there are other philosophers like Patricia Churchland and Peter Kitchu, given tried to base ethics in biology. I wouldn't say it's the dominant view at all, but it is one of the views. Bob Nozick, in his last work, Invariances, was very sympathetic to using evolutionary arguments and trying to show their relation to morality. So it's, I would say it's one of the views. It's not the only view, but it is help. There are people other than objectivists as well. Now, Marine said a difference in, between principles and pragmatism. Well, the objectivist is a very good question. The objectivist stressed very strongly that in order to live your life as a rational being, you need to have certain definite principles or rules by which you operate. For example, say you have the principle of not being a parasite, not living at the expense of others. So a pragmatist view would be saying, well, just what will work for me now? Supposing it's, I think, well, there's some nice, I'm going into a bookstore, I say, well, here's some book that I really like to have, but it costs a lot of money, but I can't really afford it. But I see the sales clerk isn't looking, so I can just sneak it into my bag here and I can get it for free. So that would be a little pragmatism, I say, what is going to work right now? But in Rand's view, that would be to be leading an unprincipled life. What I need to do is to follow, develop certain fixed habits that if I have those habits, they will enable me to lead a good life. And so I wouldn't operate under kind of a pragmatism, just saying what works. Now, it's what principles that, as a matter of fact, are the ones that will lead to a good life. This is a matter of true and false. It was Sidney Morgenbesser, who was a very good philosopher at Columbia, and had a very funny comment about pragmatism. He said, pragmatism is true, but it doesn't work. Now, Alexander said that Rand said that Hitler had an intrinsic value theory. Can you give examples? Well, let's see. One thing, say, Hitler would say, well, what advances the master race, the Aryan race, is what's good. And this, it isn't that individuals, particular individuals, value the race. This is just the absolute good is what advances the race. So this is intrinsic, because it isn't saying that what's good about it is that particular members of that race find being in that group of valuable. It's just advancing the race just is, according to Hitler, what people should be doing, or people in that race should be doing. So this is intrinsically valuable. I don't think Hitler would have talked in those terms, but you could fit it in that way. I see there's some good discussions. There's some discussions of dogs and cats. I don't have any pets myself, so I don't know. You know, Herbert Spencer wrote in one of the appendices, I think, to Principles of Ethics, discussing loyalty in dogs. So there are other people written about animal ethics. Now, someone recommends Steven Pinker's book. Paul Smith recommends Steven Pinker's book, The Blank Slate. Now, this is one that would be disagreeing with Rand's approach. It says that people do have instincts, we're not blank slates, so she wouldn't accept that. I remember the economist James Buchanan likes that book very much. He recommended I review it, but I didn't do it. Maybe I will, but that is a different view from Rand's view. Now, Herbert wants to know, what about Rand being a witness against individual communists? I'm not sure why you would think that this would violate her ethics. I mean, she thought that the communists, like you said, she thought the communists were trying to take over the movie industry or guns, and she was going to testify against them, so I think she would think that's consistent with her ethics. She's opposing, maybe you're thinking that it's that she's testifying before a government committee, but remember she didn't reject government. I think she thought investigating communism was a proper function of government, because the communists were trying to destroy us in her view, so I think she would view it as a justified defense of the action. I don't think she would have to say that the communists wouldn't have free speech. It's just that people in private movie industry should be free not to employ them. Yes, someone gives a statement that Morgan Bester said that to B.F. Skinner's behaviors, let me see, I understand your thesis, you think we shouldn't anthropomorphize people. Yes, he also said to Thomas Sowell something like, I see your thesis, you have to be crazy to believe in mental illness. Yes, he had some very good comments. Bob Nozick was one of Morgan Bester's students, he thought extremely highly of him. Let me see. Oh, someone thinks I'm doing a good job keeping up with all the bantering. Well, I always enjoy people's comments. I think someone suggested that they think during the lectures I pay too much attention to the comments, but I hope you're able to follow the main trends of a lecture. I'm not the best, most organized person. I try as best I can. Too bad Skinner's middle name wasn't Sam, then his title would be more appropriate. But I didn't get that one. And now some Alexander recommend Locke's essay on human understanding on the idea. Good. Let's see. Can you talk more about altruism? Can you talk more about altruism? what would more did you want to know about it? I mean, the basic idea in altruism is that you're supposed to help other people, but that's the primary goal of ethics here. Not your self-interest, that you're helping other people. Now let's see, Leslie said, don't hurt that child because such behavior will endanger your chance of survival. Seems wrong-headed compared to the conjugal position of hurting other people is intrinsically wrong. Well, I think that's a very strong point. I mean, that would be a good example of this view that I mentioned with Pritchard, that we just see the force of certain moral demands on us. And I think that's a very strong point. I think what the objectivists would say would be something like, you wouldn't have to think at the time you're not hurting that particular child, but if you did that, it would endanger your chance of survival. It would just be, we have this habit built into us, but the reason this habit is built into us is doing such things endangers people's survival. But it wouldn't have to, if you want to get this kind of fancy word, I don't think, enough just you have to say, that's part of the phenomenology of not harming children. We have to think while we're not harming people, that not harming people is to our advantage, but it's just that's why we have, if you want an explanation of why we have this repulsion from harming children, that would be the explanation. But I think that's what they would say. I think that's one thing they could say. Now, we have some experts on dogs. Danny says there was some kind of controversy between Rand and Rothbard about objectivism and subjectivism. I think this had to do with the economic theory that, remembering Austrian economics has a subjective nature of value theory, and this is the notion Rand didn't reject Austrian economics. She preferred not to talk about subjective values, even in economics. She didn't like the idea of talking about subjective values. Let's see, something else. Now, Alexander, Randall says, whether altruism is really possible. I mean, there are various biological theories that are altruistic, were really helping other, were really advancing our gene pool, or reciprocal altruism. I mean, I don't think those biological theories have been proved. Their theories, they have the assumption we can't act in our own interest. I don't think they've been really proved. Let's see. Marine says Zaz is great, and his nice will take over when he goes. That's a good question, Marine. I don't know. I suppose, you know, there have been a lot of people who have been influenced by him, but I don't think there's anybody really of his stature. Okay, well, I think Paul studied under Zaz. Yes, he is a remarkable person. Yes, I remember Maureen said a myth memoir illness. I was in a conference in 1980 at Albany University. We had on the thought of Thomas Zaz. I did a paper with Ron Hamaway. It's a very good topic. Herbert wants to know, did Rand over-exalt industrialists? Well, I think she had a very favorable view of industrialists. I think if you look at the people at the time, there was so much propaganda against them, I think she was probably justified in emphasizing their creativity. Okay, well, I guess we're about out of time. I'll just say, someone wants to know how objectivists respond to argumentationism. Well, I think what they would say is they wouldn't like argumentationism because it doesn't appeal to individual interest. It says you require, you're contradicting yourself if you don't accept self-ownership and other principles, but it's not making immediate appeal to what's in your interest. Let's see, Maureen has something, looks like the APA is a joke, American Philosophical Psychological Association, and different APAs. The psychological. Okay, well, thanks very much, and so I hope we'll see you all next week. Thanks a lot, everybody. Thank you. Okay, so Danny, are you still there? Let's see, what do I do now? I think I do stop.
Yes, I'm still here.
Yeah, you better do now. Stop
okay,
video.
Okay, stopping the recording.